Welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Casey Hopick, Executive Director of Umpqua Watersheds.
And I'm Angela Jensen, Conservation and Legal Director of Umpqua Watersheds.
Yesterday, April 22nd, was the 52nd anniversary of Earth Day. And we at Umpqua Watersheds are working and celebrating Earth Day every day. But especially this week, we're working with a lot of different organizations to make sure people understand why we celebrate Earth Day and why it's so important. I think it's interesting. One of the reasons they called it Earth Day is it rhymed with birthday. They wanted people to know this is a special time, and Mother Earth is something we want to really do whatever it takes to protect. And unfortunately, it took a lot to get there. We'll talk about where things were at in 1970. So today we're going to be focusing on the important day and also its relationship to the climate movement. Angela, can you tell us a little about Rachel Carson and the Silent Spring book she wrote?
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to start when we talk about the history of Earth Day, because this is basically where the environmental movement begins. So Silent Spring was written and published in 1962. If any of our listeners have not read this book, I guarantee that it is very much worth your while. It's very educational and very much an inspirational piece of work. More than 500,000 copies were sold in 24 different countries. So it is definitely inspiring. I encourage all to read it. So in her book, Rachel Carson documented the ubiquitous and indiscriminate use of pesticides and the dire impacts that these pesticides would have and do have and were having on wildlife and the environment. And I remember studying this in U.S. history. And you have to remember, you know, during this time, chemicals were practically worshipped. They were considered cure-alls for anything that annoyed us, particularly in the way of insects and pests. And along that same vein, chemical scientists and the companies that produce these chemicals, and then the scientists that serve these companies, of course, they were viewed almost in a godlike fashion, because people, you know, they use these chemicals. They didn't understand that there was any negative implications in their use. But they fixed everything. You know, they fixed our weeds, they fixed the insects that were annoying us, and so on. So chemical use for these various inconveniences, for lack of a better term, it was not only common, it was sought after. And the general public was ignorant concerning the health implications of their use and the harms to the environment, wildlife, and ecosystems that would be a fallout from them. So this book served as a warning to the public, and basically it created an awakening. It specifically focused on the use of not just pesticides and insecticides in general, but the use of the insecticide DDT. And it's important to know that while scientists were well aware of the negative ramifications of DDT, it was Rachel Carson and this book that brought it to the public attention. And to do this, she framed the issue as one paralleled with the testing of nuclear weapons, in that the use of these pesticides and insecticides and so on could be very harmful. And even if the public is unaware of its presence, and I think that's key, because, you know, once an application of a pesticide is made, the public doesn't know, unless there now, of course, these days we have signs posted when herbicide is sprayed on lawns and so on. But back then, there wasn't the warning label, so to speak, and there certainly wasn't the oversight, the regulatory oversight. So, yeah, it is dangerous, but relatively, you know, the public was relatively unaware. So, of course, she receives backlash from chemical companies, but in fact, she was even her credentials were even called into question. Of course, Rachel Carson was a biologist, but the chemical companies were very quick to go out and put to the public that she didn't know what she was talking about, that she didn't understand, and that her book was basically pseudoscience, but it, certainly nothing noteworthy. But the truth is that the book was so powerful that it prompted the JFK administration to look into the long-term effects of pesticides. So in May of 1963, John F. Kennedy's Science Advisory Committee issued a report that actually validated Carson's work. So basically, further prompting the attention that there would be harmful fallout from the continued ubiquitous and indiscriminate use of the pesticides. So the scientists on this committee even called for more research into the public health hazards associated with pesticide use. And this eventually led to the banning of DDT, and of course, more research was there to follow. So this is what started an awakening and indeed a movement with the public. You know, from this point forward, the public started paying attention. And so I just want to take this one step further after, you know, talking about Rachel Carson, and we're talking about a little bit of the history of Earth Day. I just want to mention that while Rachel Carson could be said to have started this environmental movement, it's important to understand that the movement continued to gather momentum after that. So Senator Gaylord Nelson, he was a senator from Wisconsin, a junior senator. He had become inspired by student anti-war movements, but he was a longtime conservationist, very concerned about the environment. But he was inspired by the anti-war movements at the time, okay, that were taking place on campuses. And having been, you know, long concerned over the deteriorating environment in the United States, he wanted to kind of blend that momentum with the anti-war movement with, you know, generate that environmental consciousness, kind of blend that energy, so to speak, and merge that with the public environmental consciousness and move that forward, particularly around air and water pollution, so that you create this momentum forward. And that's what he did. So he wanted to provide unity to the environmental grassroots movement and increase ecological awareness to the public at large. So this is where he introduced the idea of teach-ins on college campuses. And in order for the teach-ins to, this is fun, to miss spring break, as well as the final exams, it was April 22nd that was chosen in order to maximize student participation. And so this is basically where April 22nd becomes Earth Day. And so seeing the potential to broaden this environmental movement to the public at large, April 22nd was officially named Earth Day. And this in itself caught even more attention. And the public sought to be more informed and very vocal and demonstrative, basically protesting against the impacts of 150 years of carefree industrialization and the subsequent negative health and environmental impacts that resulted from that industrialization. So this is how Earth Day got started. And of course, further in our discussion here this evening, we'll probably even talk a little more about that. But that's how it begins.
It's amazing how much everyone continues to focus on Earth Day. You know, every year, 1 billion people celebrate and commemorate Earth Day. And it's very important that it gives us all a sense of what can I do in this world that seems so crazy. How can we agree on something? And this all this divisiveness that goes on. Can we not simply agree that this is and this planet needs to be protected? There is no planet B. And I think the laws that were passed in 1970, the EPA, the natural resources laws passed, were so important. Unfortunately, those laws would never, ever have been passed in the current political situation that we're in, where everything is so divided and everything becomes contentious. But somehow we have to get people to recognize our greatest common denominator is this planet. And that's why I'm proud of what Umpqua Watersheds is doing, what Umpqua Community College is doing to recognize Earth Day. Or UCC on Friday, staff, faculty, and people from the public, including Umpqua Watersheds, got together to celebrate Earth Day in a variety of activities from 11 to 2. And I really, it was so great to see so many people out enjoying the beautiful campus at UCC, the river, and talking about what can we do to make a difference, to protect this planet, and to make sure Earth Day is not just one day, it's every day.
You make an excellent point there. I just want to jump in here a little bit because it's easy to get, you spoke about the divisiveness of the current political environment. And sometimes I find that it's easy to get discouraged because of that. And you're not quite sure, you know, how is any of this going to become resolved when there's so much division? Can't seem to agree on anything. Everything seems to divide along partisan lines. But then we have Earth Day. And I think that's why we need I think that's why it's encouraging to talk about and recognize not just the history of it, but the momentum that it built and the fact that it brought not just communities together, brought a nation together. And now it's a global movement. So when you see the fact that you really can build momentum and you really can pay attention and work together as much as there's going to be disagreements, look what we've done. And, you know, we can do this. We can continue to move forward. And Earth Day has become and will continue to be the one day that everybody understands that this is what it's all about. It's all about understanding, like you said, there is no planet B. This is up to us. Surely we can come together on this issue. And like you said, also, it's about for Umpqua watersheds, Earth Day is every day. And a lot of other people are recognizing, a lot of other nonprofit groups, most of our coalition members are celebrating Earth Week and pushing that notation too. It's not just one day. You know, there's 365 days in the year. This isn't about a single day. We live Absolutely. On this planet each and every day. We need to protect it each and every day.
Our friends at the Douglas County Global Warming Alliance are recognizing Earth Day by getting people to talk about or post about their feelings about Earth Day. What are they doing? Not just today, not just on Earth Day, but every day, and what Earth Day means. And I think they've done it before, and it's very powerful just to see how people comment on that. And the work that they're doing, the work that the Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance is doing, where we've made so much progress, and we've talked about in previous episodes of Living Downstream, of all these groups coming together and dividing up tasks, and what do we need to do? How do we need to get legislation passed? How do we need to engage the community? How do we need to celebrate these small victories that we have as we go along? How do we break down barriers when people are resistant to talking about it, afraid that it's going to be politicized? And you know, part of the thing that this whole polarization process in our society today has to do with characterizing the other side in one way or another, where you've seen the political cartoons where they do caricatures, where they make big ears, big eyes, whatever facial feature that you want to focus on. All sides of this polarization have done the same to the other. They've exaggerated the size of this or that. There are things that people vehemently disagree on, and there's no sidestepping that. But there's elements that we can look at, like we keep saying, how can we focus on that greatest common denominator? How can we make a little progress together to bring our community together, to bring our state and our country and our world together to focus on some thing? And I like to say it all starts with community. This is our home. These are our neighbors. This is the Umpqua that we're working to protect. And I think most people really agree that this is something that, yeah, we can do this together. We don't have to talk about what we disagree on. There is a stage for that. And hopefully we can get back to talking to each other, even when we disagree about something, that we can at least give the other side the chance to make their point and say, yeah, okay, I understand that. I still disagree with what you say for A, B, C, and from what Umpqua Watersheds and other environmental groups should always do is rely on the science. And then if they disagree on the data or interpretation or that, you know, trying to weigh different things, the economics versus the immediate economics and what you have to address there as opposed to the long-term economic, we can have that discussion, but at least have a respectful dialogue and have the opportunity to disagree and not be disagreeable. And I think in order for us to continue to move forward and make Earth Day the meaningful event, continue to be a meaningful event where people making real change, especially when it comes to the climate crisis, that we start having these types of dialogues where we can first focus on the things that we can agree on.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I know that with myself, I have to sometimes make a conscious effort to not prejudge what a person is going to tell me based on their political affiliation or based on what I know their position to be concerning, you know, a different environmental issue or so on. And I think we've all been caught in that trap. Like you said, everything's been so politically polarized that it's almost like we've been pitted one against the other on this, and protecting the planet and caring for each other. Okay, this isn't just about the planet, it's caring about us, because without a healthy planet, we don't have us. This should not be a divisive issue. But there has been so much polarization. You're absolutely right. We've got to find that common denominator and work together and not fall into the trap of it being one against the other on this, you know, and especially, you know, we've got a lot of ground to cover with environmental issues, in particular with our climate crisis. So absolutely, we've got to find that common ground and work toward resolving it together. Absolutely.
Let's take a break. We'll be right back after these announcements.
The 26th Annual Umpqua Watersheds Membership Banquet will be on May 1st from 3 to 7 p.m. The event will be held outside behind the Umpqua Watersheds office at 539 Southeast Main Street in downtown Roseburg. Tickets are $25 and are available at the door or on our website. Food will be provided by Dragon Wagon Thai Food Truck. For more information, call 541-672-7065 or email uw@umpquawatersheds.org. The League of Women Voters of Umpqua Valley invites you to learn more about the candidates who are running for Douglas County Commissioner at an in-person forum Tuesday, April 26th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Fairgrounds Cascade West Hall. All candidates have been invited. More information at lwvuv.org.
Hi, this is Casey Hovick, Executive Director with Umpqua Watersheds.
And I am Ryan Kincaid, Umpqua Watersheds Director of Education and Outreach, as well as the Chair of the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee.
Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute.
We are excited to utilize our radio station, KQUA, as a platform for marginalized voices. If you are interested in hosting a radio program honoring diverse perspectives and elevating those who have been oppressed, please email your idea to ryan@umpquawatersheds.org. That's ryan@umpquawatersheds.org.
As easy it is to get discouraged because of all the bleakness in the news and the challenges that we have, I am encouraged by the young people that I work with at Umpqua Community College, by the young people that we work with in the AmeriCorps program, that they're optimistic and they're determined and they want to make a difference. And I'm also continued to be inspired and engaged by people who've been doing this for decades. I call them the giants. And so on May 1st, we're going to have the 26th annual membership banquet for Umpqua Watershed. And we're going to be talking about giants, both in terms of trees and the importance of old growth and legacy trees to the ecosystem and the smaller trees around them, and the giants in our community that are working with to provide a way forward, because they've got that experience. So I believe between these legacy people in our community, and we're fortunate to have so many in the Umpqua community, and the young people that we get a chance to work with every day, that there is hope, that we can make progress and move forward. And we have to keep focused on that and not to buy into the dismal outlook that a lot of people worry about
and get stuck on. Absolutely. So Casey, you know, speaking of, you know, the encouragement that you see in the young people and the ambition and the energy, I kind of want to go back to what we were talking about when it comes to, you know, where we saw the environmental movement begin. And so back in the late 60s, do you remember what do you remember about the 1970s and the environmental issues at that time as it relates to that movement? Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I remember it distinctly because I was 12 years old in 1970, and I was always an avid reader. From third grade, I could read a lot of material, and I would spend the summers with my grandparents down in the Lake of the Ozark, and they would get U.S. News Report and different magazines, and we'd watch the news on TV. So I got an introduction to that. But during the school year, we lived in Kansas City at the time, and you could see the smog, and you could see the trash on the highway, and you could see the headlines. The Cuyahoga River caught fire dozens of times, but the one seminal time was in 1969 and had all the headlines. And it seemed like at the same time, they were also talking about the Eagles, where we're about to lose the Eagles because of the dioxin, right, in the eggs. So their eggshells were too frail that they couldn't sit on them. So it looked like the eagle was going to go extinct, like the dodo. And then we had massive amounts of toxic waste centers. So all this, you know, as an impressionable, almost teenager at 12 years old, this was, you know, wow, what are we doing? The world is falling apart. Of course, we're still in the Vietnam War, and we still heard about Agent Orange. And it just seemed like it was so caustic and unbelievable. To me, at the time, it seemed like, oh, well, you know, this industrial revolution has finally caught up to us, and it's out of control, and it was scary as a young person. What are we going to do about that? So when they had the first Earth Day, and they had so many people from around the world, and Walter Cronkite on CBS talking about the first Earth Day and the mass movement of people on the planet to do something about that, I was very inspired and encouraged. And the fact that it's continued on, like we said, a billion people every Earth Day get out there and do something, celebrate the Earth, or focused on, okay, how do we have clean air, clean water? And yet there's so much work to be done. The EPA continues to do a great job, but there's still many Superfund sites that still need to be cleaned up. So let's talk a little about the environmental protection agencies and the environmental laws that came out in 1970 and beyond 1980, and the impact those laws have had in helping protect the Earth.
Okay, sure. So I kind of want to talk, kind of begin this part of the discussion by just kind of talking about the birth of the EPA, because this it's kind of an extension of where we started with Silent Spring and Rachel Carson. So it's, you know, during the Nixon administration, you know, Nixon was preoccupied with the Vietnam War and basically the recession-ridden economy at that time. But even so, the administration took stopgap actions on the environmental front in 1969. And in May 1969, President Nixon had set up a cabinet level environmental quality council, as well as a citizens advisory committee on environmental quality. So his critics charged him that you know, these were largely ceremonial, that there was no real power. So there wasn't going to be any influence in these. It was just kind of a figure piece, so to speak. And President Nixon didn't take too kindly to that. So he appointed a White House committee in December of 1969 to consider whether there should be a separate environmental agency. And it was, Roy L. Ash, that's right. He kind of employed him to take a sweeping look at organizational problems throughout the government. So this is where it was at basically just this time that Congress sent to the president the bill that is now NEPA. Senator Gaylord Nelson was influential in this as well. So NEPA basically, this is where NEPA begins. NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act. And the tone of the bill was really high-minded. And the NEPA stated purposes were, quote, to declare a national policy which will encourage productive and enjoyable harmony between man and his environment. And as we know today, that is a very, very broad blanket statement and very much a very high ideal, very hard to reach. And also, quote, to promote efforts which will prevent or eliminate damage to the environment and biosphere and stimulate the health and welfare of man. Again, another very high ideal. And the third purpose of it was to, quote, enrich our understanding of the ecological systems and natural resources important to the nation. So to further these ends, NEPA called for the formation of a Council on Environmental Quality, or a CEQ, to give the president expert advice on environmental matters. The CEQ was also charged with reviewing environmental impact statements, which of course now are required in all federal agency planning projects that have major environmental ramifications, or as stated in the statute, that have the potential to have a significant impact on the human environment. So President Nixon chose to sign NEPA on New Year's Day, 1970, and the enactment of this law set the stage for a year of intense activity on the environmental front. Historians actually came to call it a turning point, a year when the quality of life became more than just a phrase. So this is where everything begins to really, really take off. And it was in this atmosphere of intense concern for environmental issues that President Nixon delivered his 1970 State of the Union address, speaking to both houses of Congress on January 22nd, and proposed making the 1970s a historic period when by conscious choice, we transform our land into what we want it to become. And so this is also where, on February 10th, he announced a 37-point environmental action program. And the program gave special emphasis to strengthening federal programs for dealing with water and air pollution. And of course, 2 months later, on April 22nd, we have Earth Day, our first Earth Day celebration. So the phenomenal success of Earth Day gave, you know, greater priority than ever to environmental issues. And in particular, it strengthened the impact of this report that was created by Roy L. Ash of the President's Commission on Executive Reorganization. Remember, there was the president had asked for input on reorganization of the government. And so he submitted this report on April 15th. And this report argued strongly that there needs to be an independent agency and that it was needed to coordinate all of the administration's new environmental initiatives. And so this is where we have the Environmental Protection Agency. And of course, there were concerns that there would be pitfalls in this. So President Nixon called for, in order to avoid these pitfalls, he called for a strong independent agency, so to separate from other agencies. And the mission of the EPA, or the Environmental Protection Agency, would be to, one, establish and enforce environmental protection standards, conduct environmental research, provide assistance to others combating environmental pollution and to assist the CEQ in developing and recommending to the president new policies for environmental protection. So this is the birth of the EPA. And it's interesting and important to remember that, you know, prior to this, groups had been fighting individually against oil spills, polluting factories and power plants, raw sewage, toxic dumps, pesticides, you name it. You know, all the fallout from industrialization that had, you know, just was free flowing there. And in particular, the loss of wilderness and the extinction of wildlife. So, but by the end of 1970, the first Earth Day led to, of course, the creation of the US EPA and the passage of other first of their kind environmental laws. So then this is exciting. So of course we have NEPA, now it's 1969. We have the National Environmental Policy Act. And then subsequent to that, and this is where the momentum in our environmental laws really gets going, we have the Occupational Safety and Health Act, or OSHA, the Clean Air Act, and then 2 years after the Clean Air Act, we have the Clean Water Act. And only 1 year after that, we have the Endangered Species Act, which is vital to our nation. They all are, but absolutely. And then shortly thereafter was the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. And of course, in 1980 was CERCLA. And CERCLA is the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. And this was the program that was set up to address Superfund sites. Or so, you know, I mentioned CERCLA of 1980, is a very important statute. Casey, can you tell us a little more about it? And what is a Superfund site? How many were cleaned up and how many remain? Just kind of fill us in on this a little bit more if you can.
So Angela, let's go back to the climate crisis, because that is something that's going to be impacting the planet for generations to come. And we're just now, I think, even though we've been working on it for 30 years, just now wrapping our head around the fact that, hey, we're headed for a cliff. Things are proceeding faster than we thought. And most of us have been impacted by the climate crisis. So can you tell me a little about what is currently being done to address the climate crisis? What are the accords related to it that are helping us gauge our progress in addressing it?
Sure. That's a loaded question. And so, you know, as we know, the climate crisis is not a local or a state or even a national problem alone. It is an international problem. It is a global problem. And I think for that reason alone, it's easy for people to get discouraged, and hard for people to understand exactly what can be done as a solution. And so I kind of want to talk a little bit about first, so that people understand that, you know, yes, this is a global problem, but it's also a local problem. This involves everybody. And so I want to encourage people first and foremost that, you know, there is international momentum in this. You know, we're here to talk about Earth Day, and we've talked about how Rachel Carson started this movement forward, and that movement forward hasn't stopped. And but now we have a different issue than pesticides. We have many others, but we have a climate crisis. And so I want to talk about and encourage people to understand that we can be encouraged that positive change can come, because it's already here. It's already been happening. And I want to say that specifically because, you know, on the international front, you know, it was in the early 1970s when the UN, United Nations Conference on the Human Environment in Stockholm took place. And from that moment forward, there's been an environmental movement on the global front to be aware of environmental issues, loss of biodiversity. So in 1992, there was the Convention on Biological Diversity to assist in understanding and protecting biodiversity and to stop that biodiversity loss. And then we saw the Basel Convention on the control of transboundary movements of hazardous waste and their disposal. And again, I think, you know, this is something that our own US law of CERCLA probably, you know, worked with on the international front, because you'll see a lot of times you'll have our own laws, you'll have our international treaties, but then we have to have these national statutes, okay, so our own laws here in the United States that implement those international agreements. And one of those also is the Convention on International Trade of Endangered Species. So we are a part of that here in the United States, and our own Endangered Species Act is our implementing statute of that environmental law. So when we talk about climate change, I first want to talk a little bit more about other laws that kind of led us down this road. So we have many agreements on long-range transboundary air pollution. And we started these, this would have been after 1975, but I just remember in particular these transboundary agreements that we ended up getting in relation with Canada. And they worked. And it was for these transboundary pollutions. Of course, they start in one country, go into the other. We had to have an agreement, you know, with these, with Canada as to who was going to be responsible for them, and to make sure that we came to an agreement that was going to protect each other's population. And we were able to come to those agreements because we recognized the problem, and they recognized the problem, and everybody understood that these transboundary air pollutants, they of course do not respect boundaries. Well, the climate crisis is the same thing. Okay, we have these emissions that are warming our atmosphere. There is no discrimination here. It's all going to affect all of us. And so I think it's encouraging to note that we can come to agreements on an international level and have those agreements enforce national and state laws that are going to help rectify this situation. So, and of course, we did the same thing with ozone treaties. And so in 1992, the UN came together and established the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And this was the landmark international treaty that I believe is some 200 and I want to say 270 some nations have signed on to. Do you know what that number is, Casey? I don't have
the number. I think it is 270.
Okay. And then, of course, that in itself, nations coming together, that's the start, okay, is nations to come together and recognize that we have a common problem. And this goes back, Casey, to what you said earlier about finding that common denominator. And so that you can, even though we're going to disagree on things, let's find what we do agree on. And this was exactly where the nations came together and agreed that we have a problem that we have to work on together. So 1990. Okay, go ahead. Sure.
So it seems to me when you look at 1970, that was a tipping point where it mobilized so many people. And I think we're approaching another tipping point, both with the climate crisis and the war in Ukraine. I've got to mention the war. It's something that is impacting, obviously, the environment of all Northern Europe. It's having impact on economies because of oil. And oil is that thing that's driving our economy, the world global economy, and it's calling to attention now, especially people in Europe who are so reliant on Russian oil that, hey, we're over a barrel. We're over an oil barrel, I guess. We need to do something about that. So is this going to be the tipping point where people are going to do whatever it takes to go green, to go electric, so that we aren't reliant on oil and companies and economies and for this resource that is killing our planet. So it's a double-edged sword. The war is horrible. We have friends in Ukraine. Umpqua Community College hosted Ukrainians for several years as part of a program to bring them over and teach them how we approach education. And our friend and founder, Ken Carlone, hosted people in his home that I got to know. They're all dealing with the consequences of this horrific war. And it's sad. There is no way to spin it. This is just a tragic thing. But hopefully, this is a tipping point where we show that governments can't do this to people, their own people, and we come together and move beyond it. I mean, we've got a long road ahead of us out of this situation. And it's so scary because of all the elements that are part of it. When you're talking about nuclear and chemical weapons, when you're talking about something that seems totally out of control, how do we ever get out of that mess? And I certainly don't have any idea other than looking at history when there have been other tipping points and it moved beyond. And always, for most of these tipping points, younger people are the ones driving it. And I think that's going to be the case today, as we're already seeing with the climate change. But as we see war and know that the climate crisis is going to create millions and millions and millions more refugees than wars ever have, because it impacts the whole planet. And sadly, it impacts people that don't have the ability to adapt. They're poor. So we've got a lot of challenges together to address this, but we have to. Maybe we're the road is ending, we're running out of pavement. Yeah. We've got to address this, and hopefully it will now get the urgency that our world needs to address the climate change issue so that we can move forward and have a viable future.
Absolutely. And the way you worded that just reminded me of the melding of the anti-war movement back in the 60s that kind of merged into the environmental movement at that time. And I'm just wondering if we're going to see the same thing here. I think we can. I think we are. I think we absolutely are. We already see that advocacy against what's happening in Ukraine. And of course, the advocacy for addressing our climate crisis. I think you're absolutely right. I think that I think those issues are going to come together, and that momentum is going to continue. I at least I hope so. I certainly think so.
And there is hope. We know how resilient nature is. We see forest fires and how things rebound. It's never the same. We'll never get the Archie Creek area back to what it was before the fires in the fall of 2020 in our lifetime. But I've already been out there quite a bit and seeing life pop up and seeing wildlife come back. And the same can be said for people. We've gone through this horrible pandemic and have been very divisive at times, but we've also seen how resilient we have been in the process, I'm very proud of Umpqua Watersheds and Umpqua Community College, how we pivoted and went online so that we can continue to do the very important work that we're doing. And then not giving up now that we're coming out of it, hopefully, what did we learn? How can we turn around and use that to be better than we were before the pandemic? So that's an example of resiliency. And that's what I believe that we're going to find as we move forward in addressing the climate crisis, as we move forward and protecting the planet as we did in 1970. How can we create these sustainable solutions to that?
And you're absolutely right. We have that power of resiliency, and that in itself is encouraging. Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. When I think of resiliency also. I kind of think of these international statutes as, in particular, those relating to climate change. So bringing it back to what we were talking about previously with that, under the UNFCCC, of course, we saw the Kyoto Protocol that sought to address the emissions and subsequent issues with that. But then, of course, what is more on the minds of everybody right now is the Paris Agreement, and where countries basically came together and said, we really can do this. And even what was really encouraging to me was that you have developing countries that were still, even though initially under the UNFCCC, you had developing countries that weren't required to kind of make an accounting of their emissions and how they were going to mitigate their greenhouse gas emissions. But under the Paris Agreement, so many of them did. And these were, you know, nationally determined contributions, which restrict, you know, they're voluntary. So it's up to each country to say, this is the timeline that we're going to work in. These are the, we're going to bring our emissions down to this level in accordance with this date and so on. And of the, you know, the nations that signed on to that, I like to think that many of them have taken it seriously and continued to move forward with that. And of course, we know that you know, the previous administration backed us out of that. But I believe Biden has picked up the torch again.
So Earth Day is Earth Week. You know, it started on Friday and continues for the next week. And Janice has a show called Earth in Tune, and she's dedicating the whole show to songs that talk about the environment, Earth Day, and I think you'll really enjoy it. So her show comes on 11 on Saturday and 4 on Sunday. So you don't want to miss it. It's going to be a great show. Another thing I want to again remind you all that the Umpqua Watershed's 26th annual banquet is coming up on Sunday, May 1st, behind Umpqua Watershed's office from 3 to 7. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to have live music. We've got food from the Dragon Wagon, and we're going to have great presentations about what Umpqua Watershed's has been doing over the last year. And then we've got Juliet Palinches, who's going to give us a wonderful TED Talk on community, the importance of community that we already talked about a little bit in the show today. So tune in. We're doing really good things with our radio station. I do also want to mention that the Federal Communications Commission granted us a new license. It's called the Non-Commercial Educational License that is going to allow us to put an antenna up on Scott Mountain so that you'll be able to hear KQUA anywhere from Yonkala all the way down to Canyonville on your car radio when you tune in to 90.5. So we're going from 99.7 to 90.5, but we'll continue to have the show available online and on podcast. But now anyone in the Umpqua basically will be able to listen to the show. And we're going to continue to do shows specifically about climate and diversity, equity, inclusion, and living downstream, and conservation today, and radioactive restoration. So we have a lot to look forward to in the coming months. So please stay tuned. Please continue to support KQUA and Umpqua Watersheds. And if you have any questions, just send an email to Casey, K-A-S-E-Y, at umpquawatersheds.org, and I will be glad to address it.
Clarify that what I was starting to talk about the Paris Agreement, just because that is the current foremost international agreement that we're working on in addressing climate change. That has 193 parties. That would be 102 countries plus the European Union. And, you know, even after the previous administration took us out of the Paris Agreement, on January 20th, on President Biden's first day in office, he actually did sign the instrument that brought the United States back into the Paris Agreement. So that was a huge step forward and extremely encouraging. So I just wanted to clarify that.
So this has been a wonderful discussion, Angela, on about Earth Day and Earth Week. We were running a little short because we've been so busy doing various things for the radio station and getting out there and celebrating Earth Day at UCC. So I think it's important we spend the rest of the hour just listening to a little music that is dedicated to the Earth. We've got great creative voices that really care about the Earth and celebrate Earth Day and promote Earth Day in various ways. So let's listen to some music for the rest of the hour. I hope you all are doing well and continue to listen to KQUA and Living Downstream and Earth in Tune, Radioactive Restoration, Conservation Today. And we've got many more radio shows in the works in the coming months. Thank you for your support and get out there and celebrate the Earth. I'm Casey Hovick. With me is Angela Jensen. We appreciate you tuning in today.
Programming on KQUA 99.7 is funded in part by Umpqua Valley Audubon Society, connecting people with nature to inspire the protection of our natural world. More information at www.umpquaaudubon.org.
Programming on 99.7 KQUA is made possible by the following underwriter, Harvest Stores of Winston, specializing in fermentation, beekeeping, and soap-making supplies. More information at harveststore.biz.
Programming on KQUA is supported in part by Medicine Flower, specializing in flavors, aromatherapy supplies, natural remedies, and rocks and minerals from around the world. More information at genuineessentialoils.com.
99.7 KQUA LP Roseburg, a community service of Umpqua Watersheds. Umpqua Watersheds is dedicated to the protection and restoration of the ecosystems of the Umpqua Watersheds and beyond through education, training, advocacy, and ecologically sound stewardship. More information at umpquawatersheds.org and on Facebook.
Stripped of a song, place of our birth. We all a witness to the rape of the world.
Mother of us all, mother of us all.